Thank you very much, Chair. honorable members, without wasting time, what I'm going to do is, in the presentation, I'm going to cover the first five items, and then the last three items on governance, the AG's report, and financial performance, Justin, our CFO, will do the presentation. Honorable Chair, post-financial crisis and economic recession, jobs continue to lag behind growth. It is for this reason that during the period under review, as ITEC, we placed more focus in harmonizing our strategy and policies with the trade policy direction articulated in the new growth path, a developmental approach to trade policy, a developmental approach to the setting of tariffs, which is aimed at promoting domestic manufacturing, employment creation, and international competitiveness. Chair, in the vast majority of the investigations we completed for 2010-11, we have met the new set turnaround times, and we've done so without compromising on quality. We have done an analysis of the tariff structure for the green goods sector and positioned ourselves to give tariff support to newly established industries and existing ones, both in the green goods sector and also for component suppliers to government infrastructure programs. In the agriculture value chain, tariff support will remain critical, and the challenge is always to balance tariff support for agricultural production and food affordability, in particular for the poor. We have now, honorable members, started to tie tariff support to beneficiaries making commitments on aspects of investment and employment. Acting swiftly against unfair trade, that is, subsidized imports, dumped imports, and import surges will remain a priority. Although we have not received increased applications for these instruments for original investigations. As you may be aware, Chair, litigation has been a challenge for us in the past. But I just want to say that although it has been as such in the past, none of the recommendations for the year under review were taken to court. The key, Chair, is to ensure that in initiating and conducting investigations, we are procedurally and substantively correct. The old anti-dumping court case that you may be aware of on tires has recently been ruled in ITEC's favor against the South African Tire Manufacturers Conference. However, we will be working closely with the relevant DTI sector desk on what needs to be done for the tire industry as the industry continues to experience serious difficulties. Chair, the next slide is just the holistic view of ITEC that honorable members are aware of. Our key strategic objectives, the instruments that we administer, the technical advice that we give to DTI and economic development, and the business support services. Chair, on tariff investigations, starting with tariff increases, we received 10 applications for tariff increases, of which 7 were approved, 2 declined, and 1 was still in process. from 2008 to 2011, there has been a steady rise in applications and approvals for tariff increases, largely explained by the effect of the economic recession and the fragile economic recovery. In most cases, Chair, when we receive applications to increase tariffs, the reasons stated by industry in the main are increased costs as well as the level of the exchange rate. And so in selected cases, we have recommended to the minister increasing tariffs to contribute to the retention and creation of jobs. One of the highlights in terms of these investigations was the investigation on lattice power masts, which is the pylon for electricity and telecommunication, where we recommended an increase in duty from 3 to 15% so that this industry can take advantage to supply these components to Eskom and Telkom. It's an industry that has been facing stiff import competition from India. Chair, with regards to rebates, which have the same effect as reducing duties, out of the 10 that we have finalized, 8 were approved and 4 declined. In most cases, we decline applications for rebates if the imported products are produced domestically. However, in cases where we do not have domestic manufacturing, we have been able to recommend the creation of rebates. And one of the highlights is a rebate that we created for components used in the assembly of set-top boxes, taking out advantage of the migration from analog to digital. The new factory that manufactures set-top boxes was set up early this year. Chair, from the rebates to the reductions in duty, out of 15 finalized investigations to reduce duties, only 5 were approved. In the 10 cases declined, it is because those products are manufactured domestically or they are substitute products, and the intention is to contribute to the retention and creation of jobs. The list continues, Chair, to the next page of those investigations that we have done with regards to reducing duties. Chair, honorable members, as you may be aware, we administer 2 sectoral programs, the MIDP and for the automotive sector and the TCIDP for the clothing and textiles. With regards to the MIDP, the DTI is the policy-making authority. Ours as ITEC is to administer the program. The program will be replaced by a new program, the Automotive Development Program, the APDP, in 2013. And so this year, Chair, we have been busy putting the policy that has been set by DTI on the APDP into law together with the South African Revenue Service for purposes of administration. Those are the, at the end there, the number of certificates issued under the MIDP for 2010-2011. Chair, the success of vehicle assemblers and component manufacturers domestically has been attributable, among others, to this incentive scheme that we administer at ITEC. The TCIDP expired on 31st March 2010. However, due to the 18-month qualifying period, certificates will still be processed until the end of September 2012. The TCIDP has been replaced by a production incentive that is now administered by the IDC. And in that slide, we have highlighted the number of certificates that were issued in the reporting period. On trade remedies, we've only been active in respect of anti-dumping investigations. Now, in terms of original investigations, the trend on original anti-dumping applications and investigations has remained more or less the same with the previous year. It is quite low. No applications were received for countervailing measures against subsidies and also for safeguards. As you may see from the slide, we only did two original investigations. One which we recommended the imposition of anti-dumping duties on fiber, and the other one on pigs originating from India, we recommended a termination of that investigation. On reviews of existing anti-dumping duties, honorable members, anti-dumping duties have a lifespan of 5 years, after which they expire unless ITEC initiates a sunset review investigation. And this is usually done in the 5th year to assess the likelihood of continuation or recurrence of injurious dumping should the duties be removed. In all the reviews, honorable members, as you may see, we recommended to the minister that the anti-dumping duties be maintained to protect the relevant domestic producers. On import and export control, during the year under review, we issued 15,489 import permits. The target, which was really based on historical patterns, was 12,000. The majority of the permits were for the following important products: the fish, mineral fuels, chemicals, rubber and tires, metals, mechanical appliances, and automotive. We issued 7,284 export permits that cover the various products that are listed in the slide. Honorable members, I will end there with regards to our performance in relation to our core functions, and I don't know if I should hand over now to the CFO to cover the governance and financial performance. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Babu Tsengwe. We will entertain the first presentation, and then we'll thereafter get into the corporate governance issue. May we entertain this?
Thank you, Chair. I've got two questions. On that export permit issued, the two that is standing out immediately, that is a red flag to me, is the first one is copper waste and scrap, and aluminium waste and scrap. Now, I mean, those are and also ferro waste and scrap. Now, the one thing that we know, and that everybody knows, is that copper theft and aluminium theft is causing enormous economic growth harm in South Africa. Now, it just seems to me that there's a correlation between, you know, copper, waste and scrap, 942 export permits, and what is happening in reality. Is there some way that these things that you red flag that you say, hey, what is happening? Because remember, we don't produce copper products, but we export the scraps. So there's no way that it can be South African produced products. So it must come from waste, where the majority of waste currently comes from theft. So it seems like there is some intervention that the different authorities, that being customs, subs, yourself, should talk to each other and say, hey, isn't here something that is relating to each other? And is there some way that you work together to make sure that those are legitimate ones? That is not theft, that we are exporting and promoting things like that. The other one is just on the Motor Industry Development Program, where you have mentioned about the import rebates and credit certificates. I think I've asked this question in the past as well. Do people really know how much are those on the individual vehicles that they are importing, what those credits are? I'll tell you why. And it's from personal experience a couple of years ago. I've got a disabled child, so I applied for a permit, got the permit to bring in the vehicle for my daughter. I went to the dealership. I said, you know, without telling them why I want to buy the vehicle, I said, what kind of discount will you give me? They said 5%. I said, okay, fine, that's fine. Now, in terms of this permit, you should give me back my import duties and those kind of things. That is, in terms of the permit. They said, oh, no, there's a different price structure for that. I said, why? No, it's only 15% now. I said, no. I don't ask more from your money. It's your money and the government's money that in terms of the permit. They couldn't tell me what that amount was. I had to liaise with SARS and with ISAC to determine what the amount is that they should pay me back. They didn't know. So if there was proper debits and credits in terms of the certificates, you should know exactly what is it on a Mercedes Vito, or what is it on a Volkswagen Caravelle that export credit is. And all it tells me is that somewhere along the line, there's not proper checks and balances in terms of these debits and credits of these certificates. So who controls that government is eventually getting what they are supposed to be getting in terms of duties? Because that manufacturer, that dealer, couldn't tell me. They couldn't tell me. They had absolutely no idea what that amount was. And how do you deal with that? Because first of all, a consumer needs to be protected, but secondly, government needs to protect it as well. Government's revenue fund needs to be protected as well.
Thank you, Dr.
Ravi. Thank you, Chair. Madam Chair, about 2 years ago, 3 years ago, when I was still the spokesperson for trade and industry, and a delegation of the motor vehicle that manufacture glass windows for motor cars and so forth in this country, came to us and they said that China and India are dumping motor vehicle, especially windows and so forth, on the South African market. And then it remained quiet, and I think about a month ago, I again read that the Motor Association was saying that a lot of illegal imports of glass and motorware gets into the country in an illegal manner. I'd like to hear from the officials here. Are they aware of the situation? Is there illegal imports of glass windows for motor cars? And are they doing something about it? And are we losing a lot of revenue too, madam? Thank you, Chair.
The thanks, Dr. Rang. If you read the report, there is something that they've investigated to that regard from India. The unframed clauses. Yeah. I think they can expatiate on that. But if you go through the report, they have. Babu Mabasa.
Thanks, colleague chair. Thanks for the input that they thank you were and the team. My first question is how does ITEC have a machinery inbuilt to differentiate between SMMEs and cooperatives versus long-standing big businesses, so that as you intervene and act, you take into consideration the history of South Africa? And then the second point, my second point is my second point is on slide on the, I think I'm missing the numbering, but it says tariff investigations continued. The first item there is proactive investigation. I'm missing how to refer. But I don't know if we are together. The first line says ITEC proactive investigation, and then approved amendment 25% to free of duty. Have I taken you to the right page? Oh,
yes.
Okay. In the fourth line, 1, 2, 3, 5, the fifth one, I'm asking you to speak more at length on that, because it will make me to understand better the principle of how the application was declined, just so that I check if my understanding of the principle is correct. Thanks, colleague chair.
Okay, thank you. Babu Mduli.
Thanks, Chairperson. I want to check the auto sector, particularly the cars and trucks, where you find that there are some companies who are manufacturing cars here. They are based here, but you find that some of their models are not made here. They import. Are they treated like just a company importing? Component from outside, or if they get a leverage to say, because you are producing, you are a South African manufacturer, because you find that they are building the cars here, but the other half of it is important. I want to check the tariff there. How does it work?
Thank you. Any other? One can I give about what else? But thank you. I just wanted to find out, in terms of your the information provided here. I'm not too sure whether I understand what you're saying here with regards to the acrylic blankets investigation. In terms of your report, you seem to have referred to the type of anti-dumping investigation as a sunset review, and the explanation of a sunset review, you're saying, is undertaken when a domestic industry submits demonstrable evidence that the expiry of the anti-dumping duties after the normal 5 years of existence would likely lead to the continuation or recurrence of dumping and casual injury or causal injury. Due to the fact that none of the importers nor exporters were available for or were cooperating with you, so to say, you decided to leave. If I were to read your report, the Commission recommended that the existing anti-dumping duties on acrylic blankets imported from Turkey, I think you wanted to say also from Republic of China, be maintained at the levels as you put there. What does this mean in essence? I'm trying to understand your anti-dumping practice in terms of how you recommend to the minister, and what are you envisaging to get out of this, especially in response to the people who've applied for lowering of tariffs because of this anti-dumping practice. Secondly, I wanted to, while still there, we were earlier with the IDC discussing the issue around the clothing and textiles challenges. Companies' challenges in South Africa, the fact that the majority have closed down due to the challenges they are facing with the coming in of imports from China, cheap imports from China. And we wanted to understand as to what's the role of the regulatory bodies like yourself in ensuring that we don't find majority of them in the market at the expense of our local manufacturers. I know that you've been asking this question, but it's quite clear that members are not satisfied. That's why we continue to ask this question until we are sure that the regulations applied are really protecting South Africans and not just consumers, but also as producers of some of the goods that are being imported. I would like to get your thing, your response to that regard, and just to check with the customs issues also, whether are you working together in this regard, so that you are able to, we're not saying we should not invite investments, but it must be a responsible investment. That's what we're trying to say. I'll hand over to you, Mr. Senior.
Thanks, Chair. on the first question by Honorable Marie on export permits issued in respect of copper waste and scrap, we administer the export permits for copper waste and scrap in partnership with the South African Police as well as SARS. Well, our role is, before we issue a permit, amongst others, we must verify that the exporter is an authentic exporter. In other words, there is a site where there is the scrap that is due for exports. The inspection of containers is the responsibility of customs. So our role ends as far as verifying that this exporter is, in fact, an authentic exporter. It's true that there is a problem of stolen copper wires that get exported as scrap. This is something that I will raise going back, and maybe in future we can give a better answer to this question in terms of what we are doing as ITEC, SARS, and the South African Police to address this problem. It's a problem that also Business Against Crime has been very much preoccupied with. I doubt if government is succeeding on this one, but let me make that commitment that we will provide the committee with a full brief as to what is being done with regards to copper waste and scrap. The question on, do consumers and companies know exactly what is it that gets charged with regards to import duties on imported motor vehicles? It's SARS and ITEC experts that must advise what the duties that have to be levied are. I would say that government agencies know because they do the administration. But whether consumers are aware, you have a point there. But then on the side of government, it would be SARS and ITEC experts that would advise on the applicable duties.
My concern was more with the importers and exporters of vehicles.
The companies,
they didn't know, and they were the ones that...
Their officials should know who are responsible for... I take your point, Honorable Murray. But on the side of government, we know exactly what is it that should be levied on imported motor vehicles, even when those motor vehicles, and as in this particular case, are imported under a special rebate.
Can we all be educated on this matter? Because I found it quite interesting as Mr. Murray was raising. I don't think we all well versed with, conversant with what you were saying. I got interested in the question you were asking, Mr. Murray, because we all consumers, like you, as much as we are members of parliament, so that when we come across that particular issue, we are able to also thought you should get the permission.
Can I give you?
You can, and then
Okay, it is obviously in the country that I'm speaking with is where you in terms of the policies in the case that I'm talking about is where you import a special vehicle for the purpose of the transportation of a person with disabilities. Now the government policy makes provision that you can apply for an import permit, and it means that you can then bring it in duty free. Now, but so in other words, it's cheaper because it's a more, mostly it is a more expensive vehicle that and its purpose made adaptations and things like that. So that I think is a gesture from government side to say that people with disabilities we will assist in that regard. But now you go to the dealer, and in my case, there would have been a 5% difference in the price. So I said, no, you cannot discriminate negatively towards people with disabilities, because I was not asking more discount. If you give me a 5% discount, and eventually, because it's now for a disabled person, you are only prepared to give back what government is supposed to give me back, then you are discriminating. And I said, no, that doesn't work like that. Yeah, but it's I said, no. If it's unfair discrimination, I'll fight you. And eventually, with the assistance of ITAC and with SARS, we established exactly what the rebate was, and eventually they refunded me the correct amount. So, and I just learned from that, they don't just accept it, because what in that specific case would have mean that net that dealer or the manufacturer would have been 5% better off purely because it was for a disabled person. I said, no. Cannot work like that. And that is where I found that they didn't know, because they didn't give you a discount plus the duties.
Mm.
They said, no, now we're only giving you a bigger discount.
Mm.
And I said, I'm not interested in a bigger discount. I'm interested in the government's money.
Yeah.
And that is a difference that they couldn't tell me. And I tell you, I've got an email on my computer now of a person who is a quadriplegic. And he also went to a dealer, and they cannot tell him. They cannot tell him. They cannot tell him what it is.
Unless the consumer contacts,
yes,
SPARS and ITAC.
Absolutely. Absolutely. But obviously, what does the layman do? He goes to Ford or Mercedes or Volkswagen or whoever. I mean, that's where he goes.
Okay. I think it shows a gap. That obviously, perhaps ITAC must talk to, because if the consumer is not aware, it means certain things might be happening somehow. And most dealerships are very, very clever, and they like outsmarting people. So I think it calls on you, Mr. Senior, that you begin to popularize some of these programs so that people can be aware of what is due to them, what government is actually, how government is intervening in certain aspects or incidences. So they are on the know-how. I'm hearing this for the first time. I was not even aware. Which to me is quite educative. I'm learning. We all learn every day. So I think even people who are interested or working closely in the constituencies with people with disabilities, I think this is one area where we should be looking at. Okay. Vaxeng, you both want to share something related to that?
No, sure.
Before I hand over to Mr. Mabasa for a follow-up. Yeah, maybe to appraise you, Babu Sengiwe, we have decided that with follow-up, members would immediately after your response ask that follow-up question without going through the chair sometimes. Babu Mabasa, you may continue.
I wanted to suggest that ITAC also works closely with the consumer agency, you know, because they conduct workshops on issues affecting the consumer. This is a very interesting point, and as the chair says, on our part as well, we will communicate on this.
Thanks, Honorable Chair. With regards to the questions raised by Dr. Rabi, I'm sorry, on the dumping of automotive glass, particularly from China and India, let me state that one of the products that are currently protected in terms of anti-dumping duties is automotive glass, in the main produced by PG. So we do have existing duties besides the investigation that you see that we have done on mirrors from India, where we also have anti-dumping duties in place. Nothing has been brought to the attention of ITEC by the Association of Component Manufacturers with regards to fraudulent or illegal importation of glass. Yeah, that's what I would say in terms of what measures we have in place to protect domestic manufacturers of automotive glass. Honorable Mabasa, in the main, the nature of our instruments is such that we do not differentiate between the big players and the small players, the SMMEs. If an application, for example, is brought to us by a particular industry, that investigation or application covers the whole industry. And so when we apply tariffs, we will not differentiate between the big players and the small players. The tariff would be applicable to all. We do have cases in import control where we have tried to give effect to this principle of differentiation, where with respect to our import control measures, we are restricting the importation of second-hand machinery and equipment, agriculture machinery and equipment. But for the small-scale farmers, the emerging farmers, we have relaxed that restriction so that they can access agriculture, machinery, and equipment secondhand at prices that are cheaper than they would have done. All I'm trying to say is that for most of our instruments, we do not have that flexibility. Honorable Ntuli, the question was on how importers use credit certificates to import either, in the main you were saying, to import fully built up motor vehicles. What happens is that the way the MIDP works is based on your exports, you receive an import rebate credit. That credit you can use to import either components or motor vehicles duty-free. or you can sell to importers that are not manufacturing at all domestically for them to import duty-free. So that's how the certificates work. You get a credit for a certain amount to import either motor vehicles or components duty-free.
In other words, you mean you can be able to benefit, let's say you are making cars here.
Yes.
But the chunk is made in Japan. Now you want to bring the other cars you are not making because we've got the certificate to manufacture cars, but in fact most of them are from overseas, then you make a fortune in that way.
Yes, you do, Honorable Ntuli. What the MIDP encourages is to reduce the different models that you produce as an assembler. If your models are reduced and you specialize to produce for the domestic market and export, then for those models that are not produced domestically, you use the certificate to import them duty-free. That's how the program works. But it will be different in respect of the APDP. Chair, you had a question on acrylic blankets. And you referred us to page 20, the Sunset Review on acrylic blankets. As you have already said, Chair, anti-dumping duties have a lifespan of 5 years. If they are not reviewed within the 5 years, then the duties will expire. In this case, we had a sunset review, and the industry that responded is the Textiles Federation of South Africa. And they argued that if the duties were to be removed, then dumping will continue, they will continue to be injured, and this would have adverse effects on the industry that manufactures blankets and jobs. Now, when industry responds to a sunset review, they will give us information on dumping, they will give us information on injury. The information on injury would be the last 3 years, and the fourth year would be an estimate should the duties be withdrawn. And injury would be assessed in terms of a number of economic factors. If anti-dumping duties are removed, what will happen in terms of import volume, in terms of profits, their sales volumes, their market share, etc. And so on the basis of estimates that we are given by industry, we would make an assessment of whether there will be a continuation or recurrence of injurious dumping. And in this case, what made it easy is the fact that the exporters from abroad and the importers domestically did not respond to contest the applications, the applicant's information. And so on the basis of information submitted by the applicant, we recommended to the minister to retain the anti-dumping duties.
Dr. Senyo, what I want to find out is the lack of response, was it because the duties are not really making any impact? or was it, because we see this is still happening, you know, dumping still continuing. I'm avoiding using certain wordings, but is it because they can see that it's a waste of time, even if we appear, because no one is going to do anything, even if outside those terms or treaties, even if we continue dumping, you know, in other ways? Or is it because they are dumped in the SACU area, and anybody within the SACU area could continue doing as they wish outside South Africa?
Honorable Chair, if there are exporters that continue to export into our market, let's say China and Turkey, the blankets, they are faced with this high anti-dumping duty. And so their blankets cannot sell at the low prices. They will have to sell at their prices plus the anti-dumping duty. And so, in a sense, our blanket manufacturers are protected. So we can safely say that from China and from Turkey, there is no dumping, in the sense that they pay the anti-dumping duty, which increases the price of the landed blanket into the domestic market.
Okay, that's not but what I wanted to ask is within, for instance, the region itself, it can be outside South Africa, but having similar effects. I can go and visit my aunt in Swaziland and come back with three blankets. They are my blankets, but I got them through, you know, the same channel, but managed to avoid whatever that the duty that for, not for me, but the Chinese or the what you call it? What is this other country?
Turkey,
for instance. I've managed to sell to Switzerland, to Zimbabwe, to whatever country. Because I think it was last year when we had that by through you that Chinese dump in Zimbabwe, and then what Zimbabweans do, they just change the label and, you know, direct to South Africa. That's what we had last time. And is it not tricking the system? And are we not, what are we doing about that in terms of the customs union regulations and laws?
Sure, can I?
Or am I making it too
complicated? No, I understand you, Chair.
Okay. You want to add in? Okay.
No,
I wanted to, so that you can be aware of this thing of the companies, the manufacturers of cars. I'm saying this from the experience that they've, you know, at Toyota, they had many lines and many employees manufacturing cars, but all of a sudden they just kill all the other lines. Let's say high-end, this, they just kill those lines, and then there was attrition for the for employees. Then they just concentrated on few models, and the bank now is being, imported as a completed component. Now, I'm saying this, it's seemingly, and everything has changed, that the Japanese has become the complete owner of the company. In fact, as before, it was South Africans also having shares. But all of a sudden now it has gone back to Japan, and they've closed main lines of other components. and then they are importing all those cars which were made here. And now, if you know that some of the cars, they are cheaper when they are from overseas than when it is made here. Now, they simply close all those lines, and then they import all those components from overseas, and then they retain few lines here, so that they still being regarded as the manufacturers of but most of these cars are being imported. Now I'm saying, are you aware that because that obviously it is killing our jobs here in South Africa, because most of the employees now they no longer, but they're still producing the same cars, but they import them.
Thanks, Chair. Chair, on your question on the movement of goods intra-SACU, the movement of goods within SACU, there are customs control procedures. Customs control procedures that would cap any fraudulent or illegal importation of goods that were destined either for Botswana, Lesotho, Namibia, or Swaziland into the South African market. I don't know, Chair, if they may, in terms of the border controls, pick up one or two blankets by an individual, but when it comes to large consignments that would have an impact on the domestic manufacturers, we do have customs control procedures and cooperation between the customs authorities in SACU. The other question, Chair, where maybe a SADC member would import finished goods, say from China, shirts, and all they do is to label them and export them into the South African market as if they were manufactured in Zimbabwe. Even there, trade within SADC is regulated by rules of origin. So what it means is that there will be a specified standard for the production of a shirt in SADC for it to be exported into the South African economy. An example might be the fabric was imported, but then cut, make, and trim was done in Zimbabwe. So there are those rules of origin that would protect the South African market from goods imported from China via Zimbabwe landing into the South African market.
How effective are these rules?
They are effective.
Right now, during RASPI, actually, the RASPI season now, we just heard that on the streets there are those counterfeits of the goods that are being sold on the streets. How do they come in, or how are they allowed?
Because this is
the public state,
yeah.
And this is what is in the public, eyes, and we are saying on the other hand, we have these rules which are very stringent, we have monitors, we have all that, but at the same time, we still find these things happening. And when you talk of breakthroughs by the police, by the army in the border, it's good that now the borders are now reinforced by army personnel and all that. But the results are not that good. They are, but I don't think they are as effective because they come long after this interaction, so transactions have been made. I just want to understand that, because last time when you briefed us, if I recall well, you alluded to the fact that there are some of SADC countries that do not want to cooperate fully with South Africa. And the fact that South Africa so far within the region is the only country that seems to be well established in terms of structures and so forth. So with that gap, how then can you confidently say they will be able then to detect such things happening within their boundaries?
Thanks. Let me start by agreeing with you that there is a problem of fraudulent and illegal importation of clothing and textiles. Now, this requires a coordinated response by various government agencies. There is a task team in place under NEDLAC that is constituted of all the relevant agencies, including ITEC, SARS, Business and Labor. And SARS has now, amongst other things, looked at having dedicated ports just for clothing and textiles. There are cases where there are companies that have been caught on the wrong side of the law as a result of the measures that customs has put in place. Chair, on the side of ITEC, we have a 45% duty on clothing, and on fabrics we have a duty of 22%. Well, the biggest problem has been under invoicing. As a result of under invoicing, lesser duties are being paid and collected. That's a customs matter. Customs has been looking at an option of having reference prices, that is, for all imported different kinds of clothes, there would be a set price. And so if imports come in at very cheap prices, duties will have to be paid on that reference price. I do not know, Chair, if that has been implemented yet. My understanding is that it has not yet been implemented. So the biggest problem, Chair, is that of under invoicing. And yeah. Honorable Nduli, on the question of motor vehicle assemblers reducing their production line, the MIDP is structured such that it encourages rationalization, specialization in certain models that would be produced in high volume, particularly for export markets. Of course, it is also focusing on producing for the domestic market. And so for those models that will not be produced domestically because of the rationalization and specialization, increasing volumes, those will be imported. So the MIDP has two sides, promoting exports but at the same time allowing for the importation of models that are not produced domestically. If I may, Honorable Nduli, the automotive sector is the biggest contributor to GDP in the total manufacturing sector. It's the most resilient. Much as other sectors like clothing and textiles, we've seen a decline in jobs. With regards to the automotive sector, jobs have been almost maintained more or less at the same level over time. And this has been attributable to the MIDP. We've seen last year and this year the industry making announcements on future investments. So in manufacturing, it's the industry that's doing relatively well more than any other. So I wouldn't say that because the MIDP also encourages the importation of motor vehicles, as a result of that, the economic performance of the industry is on the decline.
Thank you.
And I think we went to the Eastern Cape, to the VW
plant. Yes. Or maybe let me not ask that question to you. I will ask it at another level. Fine. Any other questions? Are we done? Can we move on to the what do you call it? Administration issues, cooperative governance issues.
Thank you, Honourable Chair and Honourable Members. I will now present the report on corporate governance, the Auditor General report, and the financial performance of ITAC for the 2010-2011 financial year. Commencing on corporate governance, the corporate governance strategies of ITAC are in accordance with the PFMA, and we wish to report that ITAC also has and approved supply chain management delegations of authority and supply chain management policy, which is aligned to the National Treasury Supply Chain Management Framework. In terms of internal financial controls, these focus on the critical risk areas, which are identified by management and reviewed by the audit committee, and the ITAC Exco and the governing structures are confident that the standards that have been set and the systems of internal control and accounting control that have been implemented are adequate to ensure the integrity and the reliability of the financial statements and the accountability of ITAC's assets. We wish to further report that these systems are continuously monitored throughout the year by both management and internal audits. ITAC has an independent risk management process in place to enable management to effectively identify, evaluate, and assess its risks. And the internal auditors monitor the prescribed procedures of risk management in line with the Treasury regulation. Honourable Chair and members, the ITAC Exco has reviewed ITAC systems of internal control and risk management for the year ended 31 March 2011. And it's of the opinion that its systems of internal control and risk management were effective for that period under review. In terms of the highlights of the Audit Committee report, the Audit Committee held 4 meetings in the year under review, and the Audit Committee is confident and satisfied with the system of internal control applied by ITAC over financial risk and risk management. It is also confident and satisfied that the content and the quality of monthly and quarterly reports prepared and issued by the accounting authority of ITAC during the year under review, and that the internal audit function is operating effectively. Honourable Chair and members, I wish to move on to the report of the Auditor General, and just to once again mention a few highlights from that report. Firstly, I wish to report that for the year ended 31 March 2011, ITAC received an unqualified audit report. Mentioned in that report were certain issues. One had to do with the compliance with laws and regulations, where the Auditor General mentioned that the procurement and contract management issue where goods and services with a value of 97,104 rand were procured without inviting at least three written quotations from prospective suppliers as per Treasury Regulations 16A61. And as such, that expenditure was disclosed in Note 25 as irregular expenditure, but that expenditure was also condoned in the course of the financial year, and at the end of the year there was no irregular expenditure as a balance. In terms of the predetermined objectives, it was reported that the indicators against predetermined objectives were not consistent with the approved strategic plan. The Auditor General further reported that for the selected objectives, 47% of the planned and reported indicators were not clear, as unambiguous data definitions were not available to allow for data to be collected consistently. And for the selected objectives, they also reported that valid performance management processes and systems that produce actual performance against planned indicators did not exist for 47% of the indicators. Honourable Chair and members, I will move on to the financial performance matters. In terms of the operating results for the financial year ended 31 March 2011, the surplus for the period was 2,675,920 rand, and the interest received in the year was 1.3 million. That's 1,357,215. The comparative figures are also stated for last year as 1.7 million rounded, and the interest collected last year was 1.7 million as well. ITAC was granted permission by National Treasury to retain an amount of 14.1 million, being the 2008 accumulated surplus. Of this amount, 10.4 million was set aside for a job evaluation exercise and capital expenditure, and in the year under review, 1.2 million was transferred to other income for depreciation recovery on capital items funded from the CAPEX approved portion of the retained surplus. ITAC did submit a request to National Treasury to retain the 2009 surplus of 4.1 million, and an approval was granted, and ITAC is still awaiting National Treasury approval to retain the 2010 and 2011 surpluses. Focusing on the statement of financial performance at a high level, the assets of the organization of ITAC stands at 23.3 million, that's 23,398,504. That's the current assets, and the non-current assets is 3,045,533, bringing the total assets to 26,444,037. The total assets of 26 million as compared to the total liabilities of 9,032,812, which is further split into our current liabilities of 6.3 million and the non-current liabilities of 2.6 million. The balance of the figure on the liabilities is the accumulated surplus, that I referred to earlier on, and that is sitting at 17.4 million for the year ended 31 March 2011. In terms of the statement of financial performance, the revenue of ITAC for the year was 66.9 million, of which the government grants amount to 64.3 million, and that is 96% of our total revenue. The other two components is interest income of 1.3 million and other income of 1.2 million. On the side of expenditure, the total expenditure for the year was 64,307,472, and personnel costs is the highest amount category in the expenditure, which is 47,696,987, and this constitutes 74% of the total expenditure. Operating costs, as I mentioned, below is 14,851,361, and this constitutes 23% of the total expenditure. Taking away the expenditure from the revenue, the surplus for the year is reflected as 2,675,920. The next slide is a slide to depict the split on the revenue and the expenses into the different categories. And as I mentioned earlier on, government grants on revenue constitute 96%, whilst on the expenses, the personnel cost constitutes 74% of our cost. Honourable Chair and members, the statement of changes in net assets is a reconciliation to show the balance of the surplus of the retained income as depicted in the statement of financial performance, and that is again shown as 17,411,225 as at the end of 2011. We wish to also report on the aspect of fruitless and wasteful expenditure. For the year under review, the amount of fruitless and wasteful expenditure was 2,858 Rand, being interest and penalties paid to SARS, and that arose as a result of a short payment that SARS alleged we had made to them, and they raised interest and penalties on that amount of 13,000 Rand. And finally, Honourable Chair and members, we wish to report that all of the Auditor General recommendations relating to the 2009-10 audit findings have been implemented. All matters were resolved in the current financial period or the financial period under review. And we wish to further state that all audit recommendations relating to the 2010-2011 financial year have been addressed where applicable. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you for the presentation on the corporate governance. Members, can we interact? Mr. Mare, Babu
Mabal. Madam Chair, just a small thing. I mean, I think in terms of the functions of ITAC, and obviously in a relative limited scope in terms of how you apply your money as well, really prescribed how you do that. It seems like you've done a fairly good job. Although one must just ask the question in terms of that compliance, how did it happen that that you didn't comply? You know, it might be a small amount, 97,000 rand, but it's the principle. Is it because of human error, people that just didn't comply? Because I think the moment that people see, you know, you haven't got three quotations, it means that, you know, hey, corruption, that's what everybody is saying. And I mean, I don't pick that up, and I don't think it's necessary to cry foul, but I think this is a bit of a red splash on your otherwise very good record. How did that happen, and what did you do to make sure that neither small amounts nor big amounts will in the future appear again due to this? Thank you.
Thank you.
Let me congratulate you for the unqualified audit report, but also seek more clarity on the third page from the bottom. But I note that this the 2858 as a matter of principle, you have addressed it so that it doesn't happen again. I note that was at the last presentation. But on hindsight, what if you go a bit into detail, what had caused this problem?
Okay, any other hand? Mr. Sangwe, may I hand over to you?
Thank you, Honourable Chair. I will respond to the questions. And the first question that is raised by the Honourable Mr. Murray. The non-compliance of 97104 is an issue we fought very hard with the AGSA, because we ourselves did not want to accept it as a non-compliance. It related to three suppliers, essentially, and all three suppliers are in some way contracted to us for services. For example, we have a VIP payroll system and an ACTAP accounting system. And these costs of 97104 related to the support given by ACTAP for the ACTAP system and by VIP as and when we encountered problems with the system like any organization would. What we did is we elected to use the sole supplier option because they would be the sole supplier in this regard. But because they were emergency cases and the consultant came in, we then had the approval after and not before they had come in. And so that is what the Auditor General raised as a non-compliance. But it was actually a sole supplier appointment in those instances. What we have done to remedy the situation, of course, is that we have upfront approvals now as submissions indicating that we will make use of the services as and when it becomes necessary based on the prevailing rates of the consultant fees at that time.
Thank you.
Thank you. The question raised by Honourable Mr. Mabasa on the clarity regarding the fruitless and wasteful expenditure of 2858. It was really our intention not to contribute to the overall pool reported by the AGSA on fruitless and wasteful expenditure. This was a grey area for us. We had compiled our report for payment to SARS, and we were assisted in the process by the VIP consultants who themselves understand the reporting. But SARS had then indicated to us, when they came back to us a few months later, that we had short paid them by 13,000 Rand, for which they charged us interest and penalties. The first response when dealing with SARS is to pay the interest and penalties before it grows any bigger, and then to challenge the issue. So the first thing we did is we paid the interest and penalty, and then we chose to seek more clarity from them and show them our recon versus their recon. And the processes in SARS, at SARS, has been slow in coming back to tell us then where we have gone wrong, as they have indicated to us to say that we had underpaid by 13,000. And it seems like that response would never be forthcoming from themselves now that we have paid the interest and penalties. So that is really the dilemma that we were in that particular situation.
And what recourse do you have in that
situation? Going forward, of course, we have all of our reports thoroughly checked, like we always have, but we will continue to engage SARS until we, on this particular issue, at least get some feedback from them in our ongoing communication with them. The difficulty, however, is with SARS is that one has to continuously phone a call center, wait on the line for someone to respond, and it's becoming a difficult process. But we are trying to make some kind of contact through the VIP consultants who deal with SARS and see if we can find a person that they can really, you know, address the outstanding issue for us at some stage or another.
You've got the same frustration as the consumer. Thanks,
okay.
Actually,
in the absence of...
more comments, eh?
Is it a comment?
Yeah.
This comments have attended.
Yeah.
They are all small.
I'm telling you. You know, as a matter of interest, following on what Honorable Marais is saying, I have always been asking myself whether this thing of using call centers is a positive or a negative. And I thought maybe it's because of my incapacity. But if such capacitated people like yourselves also face frustration, wouldn't you agree with me that this is something that we must review?
Well, one would think,
Madam Chair, one would think that intergovernmental liaisons would, certainly enhance, you know, solving problems like that. I mean, I can fully understand if it's just a PGY Limited out there, but I mean, this is ISAC, this is part of government.
One problem shouldn't lead us to really forgetting the intention of a particular program. I think at the same time we're crying foul of lack of jobs, you know,
yeah,
especially among the youth, and there are call centers that are really providing such jobs to our youth. I think where there are challenges, we should tackle them head on. And not, for instance, jump to conclusions of totally leaving out such important programs. I think this is something that can be worked on, and I believe with a consistent attendance to this question, you might get to the solution. I don't see it as a bigger problem. Although today is this small fine, tomorrow might be another bigger one. All what we can say is that you exercise caution, and like you say, you do it. Pay upfront, avoid many challenges. You don't want to be in the bad books of SARS, of course. Comply. They are like treasury. It's about compliance and nothing else. So just comply and challenge. Shouldn't use necessary meetings to challenge them. and they do make mistakes most of the time. And don't let them get away with the murder, because they'll come back to you if you allow them that space. In the absence of further issues, comments, and questions, may I take this opportunity on behalf of the members here to thank you very much for availing yourself, for preparing the documentation, and for being able to respond to us. And also on their behalf, pass the word of congratulations on your unqualified report. It means you're still on the right track. And please make use of the suggestions that we have made to you. But I just needed you to answer one question. You have a deputy commissioner who's also a permanent person. Can you explain her situation? Why is she not here? Because she's supposed to be part of administration? Or what is her responsibility? When we were there in your offices, we were briefed in terms of who's doing what in terms of the commission itself. The deputy commissioner, we're told that she's also permanent. She's permanent doing what? What are her responsibilities? Are they also administrative? Or they are sort of advisory, like other commissioner? Over to Kuna before I close.
Thanks, Honorable Chair. The Deputy Chief Commissioner heads the core business branch. ITEC has two branches, the core business, under which you have trade remedies, tariffs, and import and export control. So she heads that branch. So her responsibility is to provide strategic direction to that branch, supervise the branch. The last time we were here to present our strategic plan, I was with her, but this time she could not make it. So as and when we come here, when she is available, we will do so. So that she's also present in this session.
Okay, so she's permanent in the...
Permanent.
Okay.
Heading the core function.
Heading the core function.
Yes.
How are they different from the
business
corporate
support?
Yes.
Corporate would cover your HR, IT, finance, and she would be covering tariffs, trade remedies, import and export control.
Oh, okay. So she also serves as an employee, or she's paid in terms of management post. Is it within your structure?
Yes.
Or is it
yes.
Although is it within the act, the ITEC?
It's within
act.
It's within the act.
Okay.
Though both of us are commissioners, on the one hand, we also had the administration of ITEC.
Okay.
The chief commissioner, being a commissioner on the one hand and being the CEO of ITEC on the other, and the deputy chief commissioner being the deputy of the CEO, if I may, responsible only for the core functions, with a general manager responsible for leading the support services.
And in terms of reporting, does it mean she also reports to the general manager, or she reports to the commission itself?
She reports directly to me, Chair.
As a deputy?
Yes. So under my position, it's two branches. Core, which is headed by herself,
and corporate services, which is headed by a general manager of corporate services.
Mm. Is she not an appointee? You know, I'm trying to understand, to separate between administration and sort of advisory, because commission is supposed to be advisory. If I'm wrong, you must correct me.
The manner?
And then, because if she's like that, she's your deputy in terms of the commission, and then she reports to you in terms of administrative work.
Yes, Chair.
I would love to understand that. Also, salary-wise, is it something that goes along the same route?
Yes. We are appointed in terms of the ITA Act, the commissioners, by the minister, and our salary scales are according to the normal public service salary scales. I'm at the level of a deputy director general. She is at a level of a chief director.
Oh, okay.
We are.
And the manager, the
general manager.
General manager.
At the same level of a chief director.
At the same level of
yes.
It's quite interesting. Yeah. You have a commissioner who plays double roles.
Yeah.
But at the level of.
We have embarked on a job evaluation project that would then result in the review of the scales in the whole of the organization so that levels of positions are rewarded accordingly.
You know why I'm surprised? Because you are saying she's a sort of a deputy CEO.
Yes.
But at the level of a deputy, of a general manager.
Yes.
Oh. Quite interesting. I think I need to understand that. Yeah. Okay. Thank you very much, Mr. Fengiwe. And thousands of apologies for calling you.
We are tiny.
We are also very important. That's the good way.